No alien, psychopath, or MTV host can scare me quite as much as vampires, mummies, and the Holy Ghost. It's time for the Saftacast, and I'm your host, Scott C. Welcome to episode 41. Great episode rocking in your ears today, tonight, wherever you may be. If you are in your car right now or at home, we thank you for tuning in. Before we get to the episode and the interview, a moment of your time, please, for something very serious. Did you know that right now the Sundress Academy for the Arts in Knoxville, Tennessee, is holding a fundraiser right now to help build up the farm and build up a barn for our beloved Donkey Jane, who is running for president? And we are looking to raise about $5,000 for this barn, as well as other improvements to the farm. The campaign is on right now, and you can be a part of it. Buy a crowdfunding campaign, contribute as little as $10 and upwards from there, and receive bonuses and benefits from the Sundress Academy for the Arts, including but not limited to an official Jane for President bumper sticker, the naming rights to a chicken, a duck, or one of the cabins that will be built on the property in the next year or so, a sundress grab bag of various sundress things that could include books, shirts, broadsides, who knows. You can also pre-order and be subscribed to the Sundress Publications 2016 book subscriptions that are going to be coming out, including books by a couple of our guests here on this program, including M. Mack and Neil Aitken. Their books are coming out next year with Sundress Publications. We've had them on the program, but there are other books as well, too. It's going to be great. And you never know what else, you know, there's some great stuff to get in on this campaign. And I do encourage you, if you enjoy all the work that the Sundress Academy for the Arts has done for the Knoxville area, for the writing community, and for the arts community at large, if you enjoy this program, if you enjoy any of the programs or functions, or books, or anything that Sundress Publications, the Sundress Cookbook, Stirring, the Best of the Net Anthology, SAFTA Films, SAFTA Stage, the Outspoken Movement, if you've enjoyed any of these things, we would appreciate it if you took a couple moments and just kicked in a few bucks and helped us out in our future plans to help continue to bring you very important stuff. Plus, you're helping an actual live donkey on his presidential run. To contribute, visit Indiegogo.com. This is a bit of a long one, folks. Indiegogo.com/projects/Jane for President, a barn-raising fundraiser. We will also tweet that link, I'm sure, multiple times here in the coming weeks on both our Facebook page and our website and on Twitter, which you can find us at Saftacast on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook by searching Saftacast. And, of course, you can always visit saftacast.com. We will be sending that link out multiple times, I am sure, to keep you aware of it. Speaking of the Saftacast website, we're going into the final run here of the year. Not the final run of this show. No, I believe that is still a long ways off because there are just so many writers and so many cool people to talk to. But coming up here in the near future, we got another episode for you this month. Then December will feature our two Christmas episodes, as we've been promising. We're still a little working out the details on the topics and such, but we've already received a couple of great suggestions. If you want to contribute a suggestion, what should we talk about this holiday season? We've received a couple of suggestions already, such as maybe tackling Dickens' A Christmas Carol and its various forms, some specific holiday music, and we've even talked about maybe doing a movie roundtable with some special guests about a very particular Christmas film. The best Christmas film of all time. No, not Die Hard. It's one even better than Die Hard. But if you've got a suggestion for something we can talk about this holiday season that you would love us to talk about, shoot us a line at our Twitter address or on Facebook and let us know. And let us know before the end of the month, because we gotta get cracking on them, man. And speaking of getting cracking on things, let's get cracking on today's episode. Today's episode features the one and the only, the head honcho of Luna Luna Mag, Lisa Marie Basile. And, oh boy, it was a grand conversation right on the cusp of Halloween. And here we are right after Halloween. So we get into talking about the occult and about horror movies and ones that we really enjoy, as well as trying to find the good in New York City. And what does it really mean to have a web presence? A lot of stuff is talked about in this one, but it's all good, and it's coming at you in just 31 seconds. Because first, here's the theme song.
Hey, Sorry about that. Little Skype troubles.
Oh, no worries at all. I just got in, and I was, like, rushing around the New York subway system, so...
It could be worse, you know.
Actually, I have a background video on. Let me just stop it really quick. Okay. It's super annoying. I don't know how that is happening.
Cool ghost video or something here.
I know.
Ghost recording.
I was, like, listening to this really weird recording of somebody... Do you know what ASMR is?
I'm not familiar with it.
It's so bizarre, slash kind of cool. ASMR stands for, like, autonomous sensory meridian response, something like that. Anyway, it's people who are, like, calmed or moved or even turned on by strange whispering sounds. So I found some sort of video down the YouTube rabbit hole that I was listening to, and that's what you were listening to.
I think I've heard of it now that you mention it. Like, in relation to, like, Bob Ross and such.
Yes!
Like, the sound of his paintbrush is very calming and soothing.
Yeah, apparently he's the father of it. I just figured out what this was, and I just kind of explored it. Yeah, so Bob Ross is supposedly the guy.
I can see falling asleep to him. It's very easy.
Me too, and I think I did for the first, like, 10 years of my life.
So this is a new discovery. Have you found that you're attracted to it? Like, it has a positive effect on you?
Yeah, I do think so. Strangely enough, you know, people do sort of strange things. They, like, wipe their hands across different kinds of surfaces, and they tap on bottles and stuff. I'm not really attracted to those sorts of things, but I can appreciate the calming tone, especially considering how loud New York is. It feels calming and soothing, and like someone out there in the universe cares about helping other people, but I wouldn't say I would like turn to it nightly or anything.
Are there particular sounds you're fond of?
Yeah, I like pages turning. I think that's always been really nice.
What about in New York City? Because it is a cacophony of just every sound on the planet. Are there particular sounds of New York that are just soothing to you because maybe they are New York?
That's a great question. I struggle so much with my New York relationship. Oddly enough, I really kind of like the murmur of a subway, like late at night when everybody is kind of tired and you can just hear little chit chats. It's not like loud or boisterous. It's just kind of like a bunch of different people having their own private conversation. I kind of like that. I think it's beautiful. But unfortunately, New York is just... It's kind of all-consuming, so it's hard for me to even say much positive about it.
You say you have a complicated relationship with it. How so? Are you from New York originally? Is that where you were born?
No, I was born in New Jersey. I feel like, you know, I grew up here because I started dating a guy when I was 15, and he was a bit older than me, and the relationship lasted 5 years. And though it was sort of juvenile... We're still best friends today, and it meant a lot to me. I had a rough childhood, so his family kind of took me in. But I moved kind of in with him in New York City when I was super young, and then I moved here for college. So I feel like I've been here about 15 years, though I'm sure it's a little bit less than that. And I started off loving it, and I thought it was like a playground, and that it had everything for me. And now I realize it's sort of like an emotional... abuser, in that it tricks you into thinking it can give you everything, and at the same time it's taking everything from you. And I don't know if you know that until you get older.
That's a good question, because as someone who only semi-regularly visits the city, don't know if I've ever had that experience. I know I hated it the first few times I went, but those first few times I was only in Manhattan. Once I got out of Manhattan and started going, this is Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So this is Queens. Interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear you had that experience. Yeah, that's what I think too. I live in Queens, but the commute is so insane that it's still soul-sucking. I don't mean to complain about it, but I think, like, especially in the past year, I've reached my breaking point.
In terms of commuting or in terms of just New York, I gotta quit, yeah.
Yeah, New York, just the whole thing. I think it is so amazing, and I think it's wonderful for people. But, yeah, it takes its toll very gradually. And then all of a sudden, you are entirely engulfed in this idea that you can't leave, but you must. It's crazy.
Do you think you would move to another big city, or is it time to get out into the country kind of feel?
I don't know. Unfortunately, I just feel too bound to leave, but if I could, I'd go to New Orleans or Miami.
New Orleans, yeah. And New York, the two cities of my heart.
Oh my God, you love it too?
I often tell people that these are the two cities that your entrance fee is not a bus fare or cab fare or plane. It's a piece of your heart. And they hold on to it and they say, you're going to come back for this one day.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. I think it's like one of those places that you visit and then you kind of always feel a bit nostalgic about it. Like it's another house waiting for you, even if, you know, you don't live there at all.
Exactly. I'm long overdue for a New York trip. It's been a while.
Anytime. I'd love to meet you in person.
Well, I would love to meet you as well, and I've got good friends in Queens that I haven't seen in a while who are like, damn it, we must hang again. And I'm like, yes, we should.
Yeah, exactly. Queens is a great borough. It's weird, it's big, it's sprawling, it's got like little beautiful neighborhoods. Mine happens to look like a Belgian hamlet, so it's just lovely.
Whereabouts in Queens? What neighborhood are you talking about?
Rego Park.
It's
Yeah, Forest Hills area. It's cute. It's got like English and Irish pubs, but it's also super diverse, so you have everything you need, and there's even some reading series out here. It's really nice.
New York, the only place where you can just find any cuisine on the planet at any hour.
I know. It's so crazy. It's spoiling.
City where you can wake up and go, you know what? I've never had Lebanese food.
Exactly.
Okay, I'll make an hour trip to the Bronx. What the hell?
Sure, I can do that. I can connect to 3 trains and get there. Okay.
Indeed, I don't know what else we can really say. For those who've never been to New York, go. Play.
Yes, definitely come. It's incredible. I don't know who the predominant listeners are for this show. For the writers out there, amazing literary scene here. For anyone who just loves to travel and see new things and see culture, it's literally all here.
Someone was visiting you for the first time and said, hey, where should I go in New York? Where would you take them?
Well, okay, this sounds a bit silly, but I wouldn't even take them to one of the secret kind of New York-only joints. I think I would take them to the Met Museum's rooftop where there's a bar and like seats and chairs, and you're literally just kind of planted in the middle of Central Park. So when you look down and all around you in a circle, it's just really lush greenery that like rises up and kind of like just envelops you.
Well, that sounds like a great idea in maybe like the spring or summertime, but what about wintertime, for example?
So the winter, I think I'd bring people to a bar called the Back Room. And the Back Room is a speakeasy. It's disguised as a place called the New York Toy Company, and it has a small gate outside downtown on Ludlow Street, I think. So the Back Room, you walk through the gate, down a bunch of stairs, through an alleyway, up a bunch of stairs, and finally to a door where you literally just knock and hope that you get in. And then when you're in, it's just like Victorian paintings and red velvet and bookshelves that turn into other rooms. And it's just like beautiful and magical. So that's a great place for the winter because you just are like snuggled up inside a dark cave.
And no worries about the FBI and Elliot Ness coming in.
No worries. You're all good. You are drinking out of a teacup or a brown paper bag, but luckily the prohibition has ended.
I wonder if they would do that for Halloween, is just have a bunch of people dressed as 1930s cops come in, you know?
Oh my God, that would be incredible. I'm all about playing pretend.
And having like thick Irish accents, second generation Irish cop accents. Okay, show's over here. Nothing to see in this place now. Get out of here, boys.
I would love that. I would love that. That place is actually home to a lot of like different kinds of performance groups. There's a few different kind of like plays and troops that do like immersive theater there. So it's a great venue. And I don't know, I feel like I've heard some English and Irish accents in there.
I wouldn't doubt it, honestly. That city, you never know what you're going to run into.
You literally never know. I'm never never not confounded.
Walking on, I think it was South Brooklyn, 86th Street with my wife, we're passing by and a guy's on his cell phone and all we overheard was, really? You feel the same way? Wow! And my wife and I looked at each other and said, that guy is going to have the greatest night of his life now.
Exactly.
I don't know his story, but he is not going to sleep anytime soon.
No, yeah, he sounded super excited.
So you're involved in the arts scene of New York, as big and massive as it is, then you're kind of in the thick of it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at least I'm in the thick of the people I run with.
How did you get involved? Like, how do you get involved in the art scene of New York when it's so massive and so diverse?
Honestly, the idea of me being part of anything is just crazy, because I remember in college, I like won a story award and was like 120% certain that the professor made a mistake and that it wasn't my name. And I remember, like, after believing it, thinking, wow, maybe I could actually be a creative person in New York and do this. And so it just started gradually happening. I submitted to a lot of magazines, and eventually, after millions of rejections, got some acceptances and met a lot of people who were just like friendly and willing to meet you and come and sit with you in these little bars. And you grow relationships slowly, so slowly. And then they just kind of blossom into all these things, like partnerships and nights where you co-host events. And then it kind of just becomes so out of your hands. You just start to watch it create itself all around you. And somehow you're in the center, and everyone's in the center. So it's like all of us and all of our universes always merging. And somehow it's a big scene and a small scene at the same time, because everyone is somehow connected. I mean, I wouldn't say it's like always positive, because New York is inherently competitive, but that means it's driven by passion. And I guess everybody here is just like up all night working and thinking and dreaming and creating. It's just a never-ending like engine.
So in a way, then, you just don't even realize that you're becoming part of a scene. You just kind of fall into it.
I think so. I don't ever feel part of anything, and yet sometimes I feel like I am part of something.
Did you, before this, start feeling it, have the impression that you were a lone wolf, kind of in, you know, the mercenary kind of style?
In life in general, yeah. And then in the arts world, I did too. But somehow I found some people that they love what they do, and they love what I do, and I love what they do, and we stick together. And also founding my magazine, Luna Luna, really helped me meet a whole bunch of people, just like amazing, incredible, talented people that I'm just grateful that they write for the magazine. And then so I somehow felt like a lone wolf, still do, because I'm neurotic, and but I'm not. So I'm not, I guess, which is so beautiful.
Do you think anyone can survive as a lone wolf anymore in any kind of art, especially writing?
Maybe survival and accomplishment are different things, because I think that there's a lot of people who kind of live off the grid and off the radar, and they diligently and quietly submit their work, and you know, but they don't necessarily go out and party with people and do the whole social scene type obligations. So I think that's a way for them to succeed and be part of it, but not necessarily be so entrenched by it that it's their whole life. But I think you need like social media, and you need to like kind of be out there and answer emails and stuff. So I wouldn't think you could be completely invisible.
You can, in a way, you can still survive, but if you want to really do anything, you gotta make friends.
Yeah, you do. It's like a hard lesson to learn.
Especially, we writers are intrinsically so introverted, I think.
I know. It's so difficult sometimes. I feel like the kid in the back of a school bus sitting alone.
Do you ever find yourself like, I can't believe this has happened to me?
Yeah. Last night, actually. Last night I had that feeling. Like, did you mean like in an, oh my God, this is awesome sort of way?
Yeah, and the kind of like, if you were to step back and say, you know, like we were saying, when you got your first story chosen by a professor, and now here you are, and you're like looking around going, holy shit, this is my life? How did this, whoa.
Yeah, it's so crazy. I wonder if all the people I know think that way, because everyone I know is so amazing. And I just wonder, like, do they go to bed at night just feeling grateful? I did a reading last night at NYU, and it was for the Best Small Fictions Anthology, which is like a bunch of work anthologized and selected by the people at Queens Ferry Press. They're amazing. And also by a Pulitzer Prize winning writer, Robert Olin Butler. And I'm in there with some like crazy heavy hitters. And I got this chance to read at NYU and have their students in the writing program ask us questions. That sort of experience always wows me. And then, you know, just being asked to come speak at different universities, it's crazy because at the same time, I feel like I'm faking it, like it's not my life. And then somehow it is.
So you do feel that sense of sometimes like that intrinsic, I'm a fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that fraud, fear follows everyone around. I can't imagine it wouldn't. Like sometimes I think like, I wonder if, you know, something went wrong. Like, are people not seeing something about me that they should be seeing? I don't know. It's a terrible thing to think, but I think other people feel that way.
Yeah. You come home and you're like, they're all fools. They don't see it.
Yeah, kind of. It's really weird. I mean, but then there's so much farther I could go in life. So there's people that, you know, are publishing in the New Yorker and Paris Review, which are supposed to be the top of the top of the top. I hate to think of things like that. I think it's kind of silly. But, you know, it's an extremely wonderful accomplishment to get published in these, like, big name journals. You know, sometimes we, like, define success too much by that those parameters. But at the same time, like, you have to have something to strive for. So maybe one day I'll see my name in there.
Is that your goal, or do you have other goals when it comes to your art and your writing?
Yeah, I don't know what my goal is. I think I just want to be happy and, like, create things that I'm really proud of and publish them with great presses that I love and take the time to actually sit in a garden and write and meet people and talk to them about writing.
Be the 80-something-year-old person that the young poet comes to and you're like, well, here's my advice.
Yeah, I would love that.
It's a good idea for a dream there. Let's come back to Luna Luna for a moment. You know, I hate getting into the whole writing and everything. So
okay.
I don't want to focus on writing. Okay. But web presence.
Yeah.
You are well known on the web. You have a great web presence and everything. How did Luna Luna come about?
Oh, man. This is going to sound so ridiculous. So I was working a job 3 years ago at a little college. And it was just an awful, awful, horrible, toxic, terrible experience. And I just, like, cried myself to sleep every night. And one day, because I was so miserable there, I just decided that I needed to do something to make my life have meaning. So I decided to create Luna Luna in an effort to make that happen. And it was one of the best things I've ever done. I just decided, I'm lonely, I'm bored, I'm not challenged or fulfilled, so I'll just create beauty. And then I asked 10 friends to write some articles, and they did, and eventually it just kind of grew and grew. We focused on feminism and culture and art, and then we relaunched, and our editorial focus is a little bit different. We're doing way more artistic coverage, interviewing a lot more prominent people and artists and amazing women. We're getting a little bit grittier, a little edgier, and trying to push our boundaries a little bit more in terms of our writing.
It's a gritty reboot.
It's a gritty reboot. That's exactly what it was.
Where's the name come from? Is there significance to it, or is it just the common name for the moon? Or is there something more to it?
Yeah, I think, I really am interested in the occult. So I've always been intrigued by celestial bodies. So the moon is certainly something that is interesting. But also I'm Italian and I like the word Luna. And I liked the idea of there being kind of like two moons or two sides of the moon. And also Luna Luna is just like cute and catchy. That's really it.
It sticks in your head, I'll give you that. You mentioned an interest in the occult. That's kind of vague. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so this is so strange, but when I was growing up, my father was very into the occult, and while I was young and couldn't quite understand what that meant, I knew that it meant something dark and something dangerous. And he comes from a very, very Catholic family, but they were the type that like threw my Ouija board away, my grandparents. But my dad was the type who would just buy it for me again. He would talk to me about the devil and tell me stories about the devil and kind of like let me watch things on TV about demons or vampires. Not that that's necessarily into the occult, but, you know, I remembered him talking about things like that. And eventually, as I got older, I found myself kind of interested in alchemy, constellations, I mean, astrology. I found myself interested in witchcraft and ritual. And I think it all stemmed from him. And, you know, my mother would, like, freak out when I was younger, knowing that he was talking to me about these things. But I think that's where it stemmed from. And now I'm an atheist, but I have a definite and deep interest in the occult, especially witchcraft and ritual and intention. I think that there's something, like, very potent about willing something into reality. And I like to explore how people do that.
It's not so much then about the religious tenets itself, but more about the practice of.
Absolutely. Just the practice of. I'm fascinated by the fact that people believe in these things, and I'm fascinated by the beauty and the intensity and the weirdness of these beliefs. I mean, and when I say beliefs, it's like a super umbrella term. But I really love the idea of ritual. Ritual is just so beautiful to me. Whether it's ritual in religion, in a church, or having a formal seance, I think it's just so riveting.
Is it the pageantry of ritual, or the rigidness of it? The rules that you have to keep following for every time and do it the same time every time? What's the appeal in ritual for you?
Yeah, I think it's the pageantry and the aesthetics of it. I definitely think it's that. I don't know if it's the rigid rule structure. I guess I aestheticize it. I think of it as like this strange, beautiful other world that's kind of half steeped in our reality and half steeped in the celestial and the divine. When we put ourselves in positions of ritual, I feel like we leave our earthly selves and kind of like transform into a person who's open to strange and bewildering things that could happen. And I think it like literally transmorphs a room or a setting. So that like transformation is something I'm interested in. When I see people in videos or in movies or something like that, casting spells or having a seance or using a Ouija board to talk with the dead, it's silly, and I see that, but it's also so different from our everyday lives. It's so potent. I guess that's the best way to describe it.
You can see that, definitely. It takes an internal headspace and, in a way, almost creates an alternate reality of the room that only the practitioner, the ritual participant, can see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to believe that it means something. I don't know if it does, but it feels like what good writing feels like when you read it. It feels like it just takes you far, far, far away.
Even if you don't necessarily agree with it, you can't argue with good writing.
Exactly. No, it's like it changes you.
What about day-to-day, everyday rituals, non-religious? Do you have any? Do you look for that as well in life?
That's an interesting question. I like to go to bed like with everything very clean around me. I feel like if things are super messy around me when I go to sleep, it carries into my life. And everything is in disarray and chaotic, which I hate, and because I think my life is already so chaotic that I just need to create a space that feels clean and free of things. Like, I just can't have things near me when I go to bed.
what do you mean things? Like, you know, can't have my cell phone near me, or...
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't want to drop anything near the bed. I don't want to have books in the bed. I used to, I don't anymore. I don't want to have, like, chapstick and, like, napkins and a cup and I don't know, all the things that like would might follow you into the bedroom. I know it sounds super anal retentive. I'm the least like picky person about things like that. I don't know, it's like it clouds my dreams or something.
Bed is a sacred space.
Yeah, it is. I want it to be, because life is too busy to not have a sacred space, I guess.
I had a rule for a long time, no television in the bed. Then I got an iPhone, and I found that, like, old wrestling and Bob Ross were extremely good at knocking me out.
Wow, that is really cool. I mean, you know, at least you're watching things in bed that kind of are appropriate for, like, bedtime, rather than diving into a TV show you love. I grew up, like, watching Bob Ross, so I could totally fall asleep with that. Now I watch, like, Antiques Roadshow and anything with David Attenborough.
Can't argue with him.
Yeah, exactly. Such a good dude.
So you're more into educational programs in the sense of, like, you can learn something from them.
Oh, yeah. I guess that made it sound that way. I also watch a whole bunch of crap. I've watched The Jersey Shore in full. Oh, my gosh. I'm all over the board. I watch Pretty Little Liars, which is about a group of teenage girls who, like, are dealing with a secret, like, murderer in their school. It's ridiculous. I try not to watch a lot of TV, but when I do, it's usually absolutely insane. Or like True Blood or American Horror Story.
A bit of junk food TV.
Absolutely. I need it.
What is the appeal of crap TV? Because you're a braver person than I. I have never actually sat down and watched more than a couple of seconds of The Jersey Shore.
That's good. I don't know. The appeal is that sometimes I just need to feel like a person that isn't defined by my artistic life. Actually, funnily enough, I put a status on Facebook today about how exhausted I am and just burnt out and overworked. And my little brother, he's 8 years younger than me, wrote as a comment back and said, "Lisa, stop pretending that you don't like the things in life that you like. Allow yourself time not to be a writer or an employee or someone productive and just be you and watch crude humor and stop running away from that reality." And I thought that was really on point. That's why I like it, because it lets me turn off.
Yeah, turn off the higher functions of the brain, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Has it always been that way? Like, have you always gravitated toward crap in culture? And that's not a bad thing. I was just talking last night, watching good horror movies with my wife. I said, you know, I just had a brain flash. I really enjoy crap horror.
Oh my God, me too.
Now I'm really working through my head. Why do I like crappy horror films and not good ones?
Right. I don't know. Yeah, I guess I've always been kind of interested in crappy stuff like that too. And I mean, I love horror movies. And I'll watch anything you put in front of me that contains a ghost, a poltergeist, an exorcist, a demon, a murderer, anything you name it, I'll watch it. Good, bad, in between, psychological, gory, whatever. If there's blood, I'm there. Yeah.
What are some of your favorites?
So some of my favorite horror films are The Exorcist, for sure. Rosemary's Baby. I really love David Lynch, although I'm not sure if we can categorize that as horror. But I've always thought of, like, Mulholland Drive as sort of horrifying.
That diner scene in that film is considered one of the most scary moments in all of cinema.
It should be. It's very frightening.
I won't spoil it for our listeners, but go look up the diner scene from Mulholland.
Definitely. And if you can, sit through that movie, because, God, it's life-changing. And I really like, oh my God, I like so much. I don't know why it's not, you know, all coming to me right now. I don't know. I've always really liked vampire films. I like Dracula, Nosferatu. I don't know. I like everything.
Did you start watching them when you were very young?
Very much so. So my dad would also, he was also the one to blame for this. He let me watch everything. He just let me watch it all. And my mother worked the late shift as a nursing assistant. So she'd leave me home with him. And that's when, like, the havoc would happen.
It's like, hey, what do you want to do tonight? Let's eat macaroni and cheese, and I'm going to show you a horror film.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I hate to say this on the internet, but both of my parents are sort of crazy. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that they let that, I mean, that this is how I grew up.
But that love of horror films then has stuck with you.
Oh my God, absolutely. My boyfriend will say sometimes, what do you want to watch tonight? And don't say horror film.
Are there any really good ones out in the last couple of years, in your opinion? Have you seen something in the last couple of years that's just like, wow?
I don't think so. There's been a few that I thought were very beautifully done. Like, one I think was called The Troll Hunter. Not necessarily horror, but psychological with crazy giant beings. I won't say much more. Kind of scary, kind of weird. I thought that was beautiful. It's Swedish or German, I think. And then the other one is Let the Right One In, which was a beautiful vampire movie that puts a real twist on the vampire mythology. And those were both such beautiful films that I thought were really well done. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't... You know, I watched a super amazing television show on a plane ride back from Europe a couple weeks ago. Oh my God, it was a three-part series. I'm going to try to look it up right now, about a girl that was totally overcome by Satan, and it was an English show, Enfield Haunting. And it is a story of a house in the 1970s in England with a young girl who was, I don't know, taken over by the devil. And it is apparently a true story, and it's a three-part TV series that I thought was incredible. The Enfield Haunting. So good.
Based on a true story, is it like dramatic reenactment, or is it more like Poltergeist or Amityville, where it's full force, you know, this is a movie version?
Nope. It's quite long, and it is a dramatic reenactment, and it's slow-moving and strange, and it really delves into psychology and science and trauma and God and the devil, and it's beautiful.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever heard of that one. Is it recent, like in the last couple of years, or is it an older one?
Yeah, it just came out this year, and the only place I've ever seen it was on the plane where I watched it.
Of course, now you're going to look it up on the internet and go, I need a copy of this.
Yeah, please go look it up. It's really good. Really good.
Enfield Horror, huh?
The Enfield Haunting.
Haunting. Definitely have to check that out. I've seen Troll Hunter. It's an interesting film. Worth it if only to hear just a grown man scream troll.
I loved it. But I guess, you know, it's probably not horror.
Yeah, it's like science fiction, fantasy, horror, comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Found footage. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like a weird hybrid.
Yeah, it's like docu-horror comedy. I don't know.
Right. It's like a good Blair Witch.
Good Blair Witch. I could be that. No.
Yeah.
Damn it. So you were just in Europe a couple of weeks ago?
Yes. I went to England, and I went to Spain. And so I spent like at least almost 3 weeks there. It was amazing.
Vacation or work-related or?
A vacation, actually. I quit my last job. I have a new one. I quit my last job and just in the interim went on vacation. And it was my first time in England, my second time in Spain. And I got to go to this region called Andalusia, which actually is the name of my very, very, very first chapbook. So it was kind of a weird and beautiful thing that I got to do.
What were you most excited to do in England?
Oh my God, literally everything. I had never desired to go to England in my life. And then I met an Englishman who I've been dating for 3 years and kind of still wasn't that interested in it. But as time went on, I kind of fell in love with the culture or what I knew of it through him and his parents, or at least his mother. His father is Brazilian and not English. But I just learned a lot about their culture. I love their humor. I kind of really like their food. The people are so much nicer and chill and more chill, in my opinion at least. And so I just had a great time. I just rode the subway. I went to poetry readings. I ate their food. I drank a lot at pubs. It's just better. It's a better life.
Take that, America.
Yeah, I'm defecting.
There you go. I'm squaring my allegiance to the British.
Yeah.
That makes me a Tory, so be it.
I don't care. I'm a Tory. I'm not really an Anglophile. Yeah, maybe I am.
There's nothing wrong with enjoying, say, British comedy. I tend to prefer it over American.
Right? Isn't it great? They just go for it. They will just go for it. And nothing is left unturned. That's what I really like about it. I had a pretty, like, limited childhood. I didn't really, like, have much. My parents never traveled. They never went to college. They were kind of burdened by their own choices in life. So getting to travel is really, like, meaningful to me. And I just feel really, like, grateful that I get to do it. I feel guilty that I do it. I wish I did it more. It's, like, actually a really weird thing for me. Most people just travel and think nothing of it. But I feel like it changes me every time. I feel like it takes me farther away from my life as a child, but closer to who I am as a person.
Where do you want to go? Like, what is one place that you really want to go to?
I would probably like to go to Italy and the Amalfi Coast.
Kind of almost to connect with heritage, perhaps? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that would be the case. So I'd go down to Sicily for the heritage aspect, and then, yeah, to the Amalfi Coast, because it's just so beautiful.
So you mentioned you have one brother. Do you have other siblings as well?
No, just him. He's great. He lives in Jersey. We talk a lot, and he's super different from me. He's just got all the good genes. No, he's just, like, lovely. He's lovely and patient and kind, and just, I'm impatient, and I can be kind of abrasive.
Yeah, you're a New Yorker, it's your right.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he would say.
We have that ability in us, innate, even upstaters like me. We have the ability to just cast people a glare that just somehow incorporates the word fuck in it.
I believe it. I think I've seen that happen upstate, actually, to me.
Well, yeah. You don't want to know what us upstaters think of you downstaters.
Oh, no. That's exactly how my family sometimes talks about Jersey, New York. Like, my mom is like, you're such a snob. But I'm not a snob. I just live in New York City. And it's totally not somewhere I want to live. I just am here.
Do you feel like New York changed you at all?
Yeah, I do. I don't know how, but it made me very, very confrontational. I don't know if that was necessarily part of who I was before. Probably was. But it just brought out all of the bad parts of me. The confrontation, the abrasiveness, the impatience. Just also probably the entitlement, which is something that, you know, I never want to feel that way. I think it's terrible when you feel that way. But traveling to other places, sometimes I'm like, come on, like, how did you not bring me my check yet? Or, like, how is this hotel really like this? And it's just like, you have to remind yourself, not everywhere in the world is going to be like New York. And you should be grateful that you even get to see other places. So, yeah, I think it made me different.
How do you retain, though, the positive aspects of your psyche, your personality in a place like New York?
That is the question I have been really trying to ask and answer the past year, because I feel like, especially even today, was a hard day where I really kind of doubted my choices and my direction. Should I have moved out to the desert? Should I have gone to California? Should I have studied in New Orleans? Should I have moved abroad? Yeah, I've just been really struggling with it, retaining the light in the dark and feeling okay and feeling happy, because it's such a daunting city. It's like the commute is so long. Everybody just wants to get money and they want to succeed, and no one ever stops to really take in life. So it's hard. It's easy to get wrapped up in that. So now I try to like come home and just kind of sit and read a book, or try to go jogging, do something that lets me focus on me.
And clean up the bed space and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Watch some horror films.
Focus on yourself, yeah.
I know it sounds so cheesy, but it's really true.
Plus with Luna, you know, doing its thing and, you know, being a web, how its big web presence and everything, it's got to also add another layer of taxation on a day basis.
Yeah, it does.
How much work goes into running a site like Luna on a weekly average, do you think?
It's so hard to put a timestamp on it because it's kind of just like always there. I'm just like always in my Facebook group answering threads or talking about pitches. I'm always sending the link out to this magazine or this writer. I'm always asking for people to do interviews. I'm always tweeting back at people. I'm always answering Facebook messages. So I feel like it should be easy. Here's a piece of content. Copy it into the system and press publish. But it ends up so much bigger than I ever thought it would. And I really wish we made some money. So any donors out there, hit me up. I'm only kidding, really, but it's time consuming, and I just like kind of sneak breaks like at work and do things for Luna, or sometimes I'll just sit in bed all day on Sunday and just like upload 1,000 pieces of content and then schedule 1,000,000 tweets.
How does one make money on a site, you know, like a literary journal website?
I used to think heavily about it, and I originally was like, well, you know, we're going to build up a certain kind of content and attract those kinds of advertisers for the sidebar. You know, you can use Google AdSense. It won't really yield you that much money. It'll probably just pay for your web costs. You can sell little ad spots. You can do sponsored posts. There's a lot of different ways to make money, but I admit that I haven't focused on any of them.
I wonder if we're all still struggling to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Google's just rolling out YouTube Red, and nobody's really sure if it's going to work or not.
YouTube Red. What is that?
It's going to be their paid service.
Oh, wow.
For the big name content providers, it'll be like a $10 a month subscription charge to see it without ads.
Interesting. I don't know if I would use that.
Will this destroy people creating content? Hard to tell.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. From the point of view of the content provider, I don't know how that changes their earnings.
I have no idea.
I mean, because they get X amount per every 1,000 page views. So I'd assume that they probably lose out.
Do you think that maybe literary mags have to go the route of like YouTube Red and go subscription service? I mean, some big ones do, but what about littler ones who are not, say, like Poetry Magazine?
I think it's a great question, and I don't know if there's an answer, because on one hand, people are just pissed off enough when they have to pay submission fees. And on the other, you know, people put hard work and effort into running these sorts of things and maybe would benefit from being paid for it. I think that, you know, a lot of literary journals aren't making use of what is out there for them, which is that they can call publishers and ask for very nominal fees for a sidebar ad, that they can sign up for Google AdSense. It won't be much money, but if they're putting out content on the regular, they're certainly entitled to, you know, some sort of ad money. So I think there are some solutions. I don't think it's high yielding, but I think that, you know, it's not just a dead end. The internet has endless possibilities of ways to make money. You could also fold a different kind of content into your literary journal that could like really blow your page views up and allow you to really seek out advertisers. Some people just don't want to do that though. So I get it.
That can be tough too with a market that's extremely saturated.
Yeah.
How do you come up with original content?
That's like my entire life.
You can't really do original content when there's so much out there. So you just have to find, where do I fit in all of this? That was my opinion about the show.
Yeah. I think maybe the answer is just diving below the surface. I mean, everyone can write an article about something that everybody knows about, but it's that author's very specific perspective that could hopefully make it different, make it stand out. So I think there's a lot of insincere content on the web that's just pushed out because they want to make money. So I feel like if you tap into some sort of authenticity, I think readers are going to know. They're not stupid. They know when something is better than the rest. And that's kind of something that I want people to see in Luna.
Good content wins out in the end, in the long run.
Yeah, I think good content wins out in the end, in the long run. Unless you're a huge media company and you need to push out 100,000 page views a day, and that is that. And like, you just publish crap. And you know, I guess you're paying someone's bills and entertaining somebody, but that's also not good content. It's just brain-numbing content. There's a difference.
It's the crap versus the art.
Exactly. And then there's some sites that straddle the line. And I think that's really cool, too. And you have, like, a lot of good reading material, but then you have some, like, you know, break material where you can just kind of dive in and read something stupid. There's also something I read a lot called The Cut. And The Cut is a publication from New York Magazine. And I get it all the time. And a lot of it's just, like, dumb fashion, beauty stuff. But a lot of it's, like, culture and politics and really well-written. So I really love The Cut.
Kind of like a Trojan horse kind of bait and switch. You bring them in with the cat gifs, and then you hit them with the long-form narratives.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's what I agree with you about BuzzFeed. They, like, you know, they're known for their weird lists, but then they also have some great hard-hitting news on there.
And some good writers. I mean, Saeed Jones is big on that, and they tapped him to head up the LGBTQ division.
I know. Good for him.
Yeah. I think another big, correct me if I'm wrong here, you need to have not just content, but also web presence. What does that mean, though?
I mean, I think that web presence means a very definitive niche and a very definitive aesthetic and a personality, just like you would have in a human being. Like, for example, a few of the blogs I read, one of them is Jezebel. Jezebel has changed a lot over the years, and I originally really loved it because I thought it was very intelligent. Then I think it kind of got very snarky, and I like snark, and I think snark is a really great element of their online personality. So I think a lot of people come to Jezebel because they want that sort of teethy, raw, kind of gritty, fuck you mentality. Like I said, Jezebel changed a little bit, but, you know, that's how they're defined. And I really like that. And I think it's important for websites to be able to define themselves, whether it's through, like, the kind of content they have, their site design, the way they tweet back at their followers. You know, you just kind of have to make yourself stand out. And it takes a long time to figure out how, I think.
So web presence isn't necessarily social media, but it is. It's really about your presence.
I think so. I think everybody is branding themselves all the time, whether they know it or not.
How so?
You decide how you want to express yourself. And I think in that, there's an element of branding, especially when you're kind of a public entity, like a writer or a blogger or an artist or somebody who does something in the public eye. And I think, like, if you choose to be polite all the time and inclusive and kind and friendly, then that kind of becomes your brand. I mean, even if you're really not like that in real life, that's always your web self is always going to show something. And it's always going to hide something. So it's about what you choose to show and hide. For me, I'm probably more friendly online than I am in person. I try to hear people out and give everyone space to talk. But I feel like sometimes if I were arguing with those people in the same room as me, I might jump down their throats. I don't know. I also don't know if that's actually how I'm perceived online.
Perception is reality, no matter what it is.
Exactly.
Bad way of starting off that one in my head. Like, question was there, question vanished, question will come again. Question has died, question has risen, question will come again. What do you see happening next with Luna after the relaunch here? What's the next step, do you think?
For Luna Luna, I'm really going for an exploration of darkness and light. I think for a long time, Luna has been providing a sort of dialogue service to its readers, where we focus a lot on what's going on in the community, social injustices. And I really liked that element of Luna, and I hope that we can continue to keep it in some form. But now I kind of want to move into an area where we allow people to be their good and their bad selves without apology. So instead of sort of like forming a dialogue about change and solution and positivity, I still want that there, but I also want to form a dialogue and a space for us to talk about sin and vice and darkness and the things that make us who we are that maybe aren't perfect and that are, you know, sometimes problematic. Because I think a lot of people kind of keep themselves happy and clean and smiley online and everything's okay, or they're fighting against a huge injustice or problem. But I think there's a lot of like very quiet conversations that aren't making breaking news, that aren't happening on your Facebook feeds. Things that we don't talk about that often, like loss and grief and fear and sexuality and confession. And I think there's a space for that. And I want to create that space.
You can't have the darkness without the light.
Yeah, exactly. You can't.
Should be interesting. I will not ask you what your sins and vices are. We'll have to save that for another day, perhaps, because despite the connection problems, we are almost out of time here.
Well, it has been wonderful.
Before we let you go, though, you know, obviously Luna relaunched and everything, and that's a big chunk of your efforts right there. Creatively, what you got coming down the pike, or what's just come out? What do you want to promo here?
Oh my God. So I think the first thing I'd like to say is my book Apocryphal came out last year. It's been doing pretty well. People are reading it and liking it still, which is great. But I started working on a prose poetry memoir with one of my best friends, who is an incredible writer. So we wrote this entire book, which tells the story of our experience doing a specific thing, which I can't say. Actually, this book will probably be picked up and labeled as fiction, but it is very, very much so autobiographical. But for legal reasons, we won't call it that on paper. So I can't tell you anything else about it or its name, but we're talking with publishers, and it's my favorite thing I've ever, ever worked on, and I can't wait to see it in print.
I'll look forward to it then.
That's basically what I'm working on.
Well, you know, keep us posted because I'm sure it is going to be worth the read. So where can the folks find you online then? Obviously, Luna Luna at lunalunamag.com.
Yes. Actually, we're probably going to be changing the URL, long story. But they can find me at lisambasile.com. They can find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and just, you know, Googling Luna Luna Magazine. I'm everywhere. You can find me.
You're up to date with the stuff that the kids are into.
I'm doing what the kids are doing.
Yeah. It's all part of being the web presence. Well, Lisa, yeah. it has been awesome having you on the program today.
Thank you. It has been awesome. I really enjoy talking with you. You have great questions, and I appreciate you being interested.
I am. I'm interested in everybody, and you are definitely one totally cool, cool person.
Oh, thank you. You're so nice.
Look, I say that sincerely with all earnesty, and definitely check out, for our listeners, definitely check out Luna Luna. It has got, you guys got good shit. Play us up, you got good shit, and that is also on Twitter as well, if I remember right, and on Facebook as well.
Yes, we're everywhere. You can find both me and Luna Luna literally everywhere. We want to talk to you. We love you.
Awesome. Well, we love having you on the program. Lisa, you take care now.
Yeah, you too. Can't wait to talk to you again soon.
And next time I'm in Queens, I will definitely take you up on your offer there to check out some really cool hangout spots.
I would love it.
All right, you take care.
Have a great night.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.